Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles joins us, and today is the day, her first visit of 2020. It's a new year and the beginning of the mayor's second term, one in which she wants to concentrate on curtailing the uptick in violence that we've been experiencing. So we'll talk about that and other things this hour. Welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and the listeners out there.
And nice to have you here. Charlotte ended on a bad note with 108 homicides for 2019, which is the largest number of homicides since 1993, and we experienced our first homicide of the year on Wednesday, yesterday. Law enforcement has been searching their heads about what to do about this. You have made it a primary thrust of your second term in office. On Monday night, the city released crime data statistics. What did you and city council learn from those statistics?
We learned what other cities are doing. This is a national issue for urban areas. So what we learned was that cities that are successfully addressing this are doing it in a way that they use data analytics and they draw their conclusions, and they put programs in place that what we call evidence-based. That means that it's been vetted in a way that the outcomes that you want. I sound very much like a staff person, don't I? I'm so sorry about that, guys. So what we are learning is that we have to have programs that work, but that you can measure.
You use the term data-driven as a way of studying crime. How does that differ from how we've always looked at crime statistics down through time?
I think that we're taking a longer view of what it means. Police have got they have lots of data about, you know, people that come in, who they're arresting, who goes to court, what their outcomes are. But we haven't looked at what happens to that person as well as the victim of that person prior to. And so we're looking and taking a longer view of saying, how do we know why that person committed this violent act? And were there things that were common in their upbringing that would make a difference if we intervened?
And where does that information come from? Does that come from the police reports at the scene of a crime or interviews afterward through other sources? How does that come together?
That comes the evidence base. So you take the existing cases and you look at everyone that's a perpetrator or a victim. And you say, what were their backgrounds like? Right. And then you use that as a predictive factor.
CMPD on Monday night said that going forward, it plans to use this data as a way to view crime through the lens of public health.
Yes.
Is this the approach? Can you compare this approach to the way an epidemiologist might look at outbreaks of disease and plot where the disease is breaking out to determine how to get a handle on it?
You've got it exactly right. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And we're doing that not just on we have the policing responsibility, but we also know that the county, Mecklenburg County, has got programs that they have already proven that are evidence-based, their nurse practitioner program, their early childhood education program. And so you start there, and we work in collaboration with the county to start thinking about how could we change the trajectory of violence if we know what people have experienced and we can change their lives. Can we change their outcomes now?
And you mentioned that other cities are already doing this.
Yes.
So in those cities that have been doing this for a while, has it had any impact? Has it helped?
Several cities have been very, very successful, and you'd be surprised. Chicago has actually been very successful. Oakland, California has been successful. But there are some keys to success. This isn't a thing that you do one time and say, okay, we got it done. We've experienced a drop. This is something that you have to have sustainability both of effort and financing and funding. So we have to be very specific in what we're going to do and commit. The final thing that makes those cities successful is the people in the neighborhood. They begin to believe and trust that we're going to make real sustainable change.
Funding. How much more does this type of evidence-based understanding of crime cost? How much more does it cost than what we've been doing in the past?
We don't know that now. We know that
Why would it cost more?
Well, because when you think about one of the programs that's most effective, and this has been nationally televised, there is an interrupter program where someone is shot and they've had a violent act in their lives, that you get someone that has had that same experience to meet them at the hospital, mm-hmm. to talk about the consequences of their lives and do they want to change it. And that's where the community comes in. We got a lot of feedback from a number of organizations that we're funding in a way that helps them, but we haven't given them that stamp of let's do this together yet. And so that's what makes the difference.
So this data-driven approach led CMPD to identify the four worst hot spots for violent crime. Beatty's Ford Road and LaSalle Street is one. Sugar Creek Road at I-85 is another. Central Avenue at North Sharon Amity Road and Nations Ford Road at Arrowwood Road. There were 14 killings in those areas last year, except for the Central Avenue area. There were none there. Have we not traditionally tracked where homicides occur and other violent crimes occur through the years? I mean, is this really a new way of following crime?
Well, it's a new way of how you treat those geographic areas. I probably am showing again how long I've been at this, but Nations Ford and I-85 have been hot spots for years. And what we've been doing about that is policing it. Mm-hmm. But we can't police businesses that allow for things to go on within their boundaries. And so when we talk about violence interruption, how do we begin to work with those businesses to say, we know what's going on here, we want to stop it, will you join with us to stop it?
I want to talk about the businesses in a second, because one of those areas is particularly prone to problems because of businesses.
Right.
But these hotspots that they identified last night account for 14 of the 108 homicides that we experienced last year. That means 94 others occurred elsewhere. So are these really hotspots?
That's really true. And I think Deputy Chief Smith did a really good response to that by basically saying that the homicides are a result of other activities that often started way before you got to the point that you used a gun or a knife to kill someone.
Well, in fact, he talked about that when he was talking about the hotels and motels that are along the Sugar Creek Road crime cluster.
Cash-only businesses.
Yeah, and also hotels and motels, there are 13 in that area, that seem to cater to what he called transient populations. And they were magnets, he said, for prostitution, which leads to other crimes like robbery and assault. Here's CMPD Deputy Chief Gerald Smith.
Along with prostitution, you not only get the prostitution, the act of prostitution, you get robbery reports, you get sexual assault reports, you get physical assault reports, you get drugs, you get a myriad of things when you see street-level prostitution in an area like you see here.
Now, other areas in the past have experienced street-level prostitution at motels and hotels that can be politely called flop houses. What was done in those areas over the years? And if we know about this area along Sugar Creek at I-85, why aren't we doing it right now?
Well, that's the thing about it. We are doing the same thing that we used to do for flop houses, but there's a complexity around this kind of work. There's the safety aspect, but think about some of the other places, Graham Street, mm-hmm. perhaps. Now that's being developed. It's a very different thing when you have just the focus on the crime and not what takes place around it. We've got a lot of initiatives on Sugar Creek right now. The faith community, Mayfield Memorial, Dr. Weary is talking about building homes and housing for people in his congregation that live in the area. We've got a housing development going on. So we're seeing some development, but when you have that concentration of those numbers of motels that are cash only, that mm-hmm. have the factors that Chief Smith talked about, that's a bigger problem. And if you notice, the most violence occurred on those places with the interstate exchanges, I-77 for Nations Ford and I-85 for Hidden Valley's area.
I want to go back to these hot spots. There are four hot spots. 14 of the homicide, the 108 homicides occurred in those hot spots. Those hot spots account for 2 square miles of the city that is 438 square miles in perimeter. That means less than 1% of the city's landmass is involved in 8% of its crimes. How can you use that information to lower the crime rate in those areas? And are we to glean from that that there's a lot of other crime going on disparately all over the place?
Well, crime is up in our community, like other urban areas, as I've said. Crime is up across the country. What I think, when you think about that, 8% in that 2 square miles, that is a place where you can actually define and try out some of the things that we need to work on to make a difference. And I would hope that then we would be evidence-based, working with the Mecklenburg County's Public Health Department, working with a number of our nonprofits, and also our community residents, that we begin to model some programs that are effective across our city's boundaries.
The problem in the Arrowwood Road crime spot area impacts Hispanics, because we are told they often carry cash, and that makes them targets for armed robbery. CMPD also cited language barriers in communicating with these folks. And sometimes these crimes on Hispanics, perpetrated on Hispanics, go unreported. Is that because they're afraid of being entangled with law enforcement because of its potential association with ICE? Or is it simply because they don't know how to communicate with police and police can't communicate with them?
I think that all of those reasons account for a portion of it. We are sending our police officers to Spanish immersion classes, and we're trying to hire more people, diverse races, as well as language folks in our department. But I think it's also a lot of this is in that area. People come in by a number of our relief agencies, and they settle in that area because that's where they have connections, family or connections. And so the government and the police role in this country, thankfully, is very different often from where they come from. So there's also a little bit of fear, right, from government, a fear of police.
The driver of crime in the Bates Ford Road LaSalle area seems to be a large amount of drug dealing and homelessness. Are the two related? Do you have to tackle both at the same time to have any impact?
Well, Chief Smith did a great job explaining that, too, and I don't know what the weight is, but let's just say whatever you used to buy marijuana in, as he said, was $1,000. It's now $5,000. So disputes about the amount and the value of that in that area has caused violent behavior. So some of this, you think about it as scarcity in our economy around the price changes. So that has escalated, and when that escalation happens, violence results. And I think we had some questions. Councilmember Winston asked about, what would happen if marijuana were legal, or what would happen if we would actually look at the number of known people in a transaction that violence resulted. We've been working on this really long, and we're going to continue it.
Are the drugs being sold in that area marijuana, or are they harder drugs than marijuana?
I don't know that for a fact. It starts with marijuana, is the example that Chief Smith used.
One of the problems that Chief Putney has been scratching his head over and acting very frustrated, because I'm thinking he genuinely is frustrated, about the number of crimes, gunshots, that are fired between people who are simply having petty arguments over stupid stuff that shouldn't be settled with the pull of a trigger. And CMPD says these crimes related to arguments spread like a contagion. I want to talk about that and some other things with you with regard to this study that you looked at on Monday night when we come back from the break. And we'll also be talking about Major League Soccer. And Ben Carson was in town yesterday.
That's right.
We'll talk about what he had to say about housing when we come back. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is with us for her first visit of 2020. She's here on a regular basis, has been at least through the last year, and we hope you'll continue to join us at least once a month here. I mentioned that CMPD says these crimes and these hotspots, these violent crimes, are related to arguments, and these argument crimes spread like a contagion. Do we understand why?
Well, one of the numbers that we've used in this data is that locally, one in four victims experience repeat victimization, and they often can lead to this violent end. And so when you start thinking about escalation of arguments, you just see it happening. You know, it's like anything else. You think about people that feel like they've been harmed, mm-hmm. and the only result, if they have no way to de-escalate that, they have no training, and they're being questioned about, well, why didn't you do something about it? It continues to be that.
So for those just joining us, we've been talking about this new data-driven way of studying crime, and the police department released a lot of this to the city council on Monday night, identifying four hot spots around town where most of the serious crimes have occurred. And you say that this, and they say that this evidence-based program and the solutions developed will help you get a handle on this. But Republican Councilman Ed Driggs said he didn't see anything that surprised him in that report. Nothing made him go, quote, wow, I didn't know that, then I would have done this, and that's what we need. So what's your reaction to his reaction to this?
I think that when I look at it from my perspective, yes, you can intuitively know things, but you wouldn't build millions of dollars of effort around change based on intuition. Mm-hmm. So we needed the facts, we needed the data, and we need to build, as I say, something that's proven to work. So are we surprised? I don't think we're surprised by the big themes, but what would we do if we didn't actually have some factual foundation for developing programs? We're going to have our council retreat next week, and we're going to continue to work on this issue to determine what can we do that's different, that's beyond policing, working with Dina and Gibby, who is the public health director. All of those things matter. You come to the table not saying, well, you know, this is what I think. You come saying, this is the data that we have and what we know. Now what do we do?
But Robert Dawkins, who's with the SAFE Coalition, mm-hmm. said, I want to hear more than about these four neighborhoods we already have known that account for 8%. Of the crime. So he's kind of on the same page with Ed Driggs, and he's on the front lines of this in the neighborhoods.
He is.
So how do you explain that?
I explain that because Robert Dawkins is really deeply engaged in the community, and the way that I see that is that he's working with organizations that are community-based, and he wants us to go faster. So I think that what he's saying is acknowledge what we've got for the data, but how do we begin to move?
Right. So City Council is going to get together, I guess maybe at your retreat, and try to develop some strategies, is that correct, to deal with this or to use this data in coming to ways to find solutions?
I think we've got two next steps that we discussed on Monday, and the first one was to begin to work collaboratively with the county. The county has had a presentation on this from a public health perspective, mm-hmm. working with the public health department. We need to get on the same page with them and craft something that works not just citywide. When they had the homicide in Concord, I got a call from the mayor saying, I hear you're doing something about violence. So it doesn't know a boundary. It's not saying, well, here's the city limits and we're not going to take it there. Right. So we're going to work with the surrounding communities. In fact, the report that we gave, we sent to every other town in our area, in our county, as well as to Concord. And then the next thing that I think we are going to do is that we've got a Safe Communities Committee of Council, and we've asked them to look at our existing programs and to determine what new programs we have. So that's an expectation, and we hope to be back within 60 days with a report of what we should do next how we should look at things in a different way next.
Rebecca Hefner, who's the city's data and analytics director, says that Charlotte lacks what is known as a violence interruption program that other cities have started using. What is that? Why don't we have it? Will we soon?
Well, I don't know if we'll have it. Let me give you two examples of it. One is the one that I said, if you're shot and you end up in the hospital, you have someone that has gone through that experience visit you in the hospital. And another community, what they did was they identified the top priorities or traits that would lead to that violence. And they actually identified approximately 75 to 100 people with those traits. And they called them in, and they paid them to come in. And they said, this is what's going to happen to you. A lot of like the scared straight, but not really with that. It says, this is what's going to happen. So how do we help you get jobs? Mm-hmm. How do we help you take care of your family? Do you have adequate housing? Are you do you have food in your household? What's leading? And they take a holistic approach, and they focus specifically on that small group of people that are responsible for a large amount of the violent behavior in neighborhoods.
Yesterday, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson was in town for an appearance, and he announced here in Charlotte that the department plans to reduce Obama-era fair housing regulations intended to decrease segregation. The proposal would relax municipalities' requirements to document its obstacles to fair housing, which he called costly and burdensome. Were you invited to that event?
Well, I was made aware of it after the event had occurred.
Why?
I don't know that. I was surprised that when we have a cabinet secretary, usually I would like to meet with them, understand what let them understand more about our city. But I would expect that this was an announcement. It was made, and it was national, and he chose Charlotte.
Why? Why did he choose Charlotte?
I don't know that, Mike. I'd be speculating on it. I think that Charlotte is one of our fastest growing cities. We're known as being an innovative city, and we're working hard on housing. And I think that he saw this as a way to say, well, let's reduce the bureaucracy that you have to have.
Did he invite any of our public officials to be part of this?
I'm not aware of that.
So Carson said that hundreds of communities had asked HUD to change the Obama-era rules. Hundreds of communities had asked for these changes because they were too costly, too burdensome. And here's a quote from the press release. It reads, mayors know their communities best. So why weren't you there? But mayors know their communities best, so we are empowering them to make housing decisions that meet their unique needs, not a mandate from the federal government. WFAE's David Borax was there. He asked Carson yesterday if Charlotte was one of those cities who asked for it, and he didn't answer David's question. So let me ask you, has Charlotte been asking for this rule to be revised?
We have not asked, from my understanding with Pam Weidman, who runs our housing programs, we did not ask for this because for us, it's very different. Doing this is a part of our overall housing strategy, and we work really hard on that. So I don't think that if you're in a community that doesn't have an existing strategy, it's burdensome because you're not focused on that. But we're very much focused on affordability and housing, and so we don't find this a burden. What we try to do is follow our framework for locating affordable places throughout the community, and that's what this report meant. It's actually just asked that question.
I don't know how much Ben Carson knows or his people know about Charlotte. He certainly didn't talk to you, but he criticized a previous emphasis on building affordable housing in more affluent areas of opportunity, which he said was, quote, suffocating investment in some of the neighborhoods that needed it most. In cities like Charlotte, he said, low-income areas were actually redlined out of affordable housing development plans, and federal resources were redirected to high-income areas. The very areas, he said, that need the most attention were being neglected.
Today, if you look at our housing framework, we've got housing being built in the center city. We've got housing built on Sugar Creek Road. We've got housing throughout this community.
So he's wrong?
Well, I don't know where he, what information. Maybe he's just not current. That might be one of the things.
But he came here to make that announcement, and he specifically talked about Charlotte. And you're telling me he doesn't know what he's talking about?
No, I didn't say that. I said he may not be up to date with what we've been doing. We've been at this affordable housing program since the 70s, but I think that this city council should take a lot of credit for moving more quickly to actually see real change and results.
All right. Before the holidays, Charlotte got an early Christmas present, and you were there to receive it.
Now it's my pleasure to welcome Charlotte to Major League Soccer as our 30th team.
Now, you weren't here last month for your monthly visit.
That's
we had
true.
Instead three new members of City Council and Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eiselt on the program. And I realized during that broadcast, in the course of that conversation, this was, I think, the day or the 2 days before the Major League Soccer announcement was scheduled to take place at the Mint Museum downtown. And I realized that if that thing had been scheduled, the decision about Charlotte's participation had already been made. Otherwise, they wouldn't have scheduled it. So I asked about that, and they would not discuss it. they wouldn't admit to what we found out. But we did find out later on that the commitment was spelled out in a letter to Don Garber. He's the head of the...
the commissioner.
Back on November 21st.
Yes.
So, you sneaky people.
Come on.
Exactly what did we commit to?
Well, you know, I think that what Dave Tepper has brought to our community with his acquisition of the Panthers has been a sense of energy around sports and entertainment. And he's been very open in saying that he wants to make Charlotte a place where you have more than just one team. You know, he wants to activate a stadium. He wants to do more work in entertainment. So that letter basically gave a framework for how we would plan and work together on making sure that we activate our center city in a way that builds additional development that would attract new jobs and new people to our city, as well as the Central Avenue and Eastland area, activate that once again. So the letter was a framework to say, we will work with you on planning an entertainment district. We will work on planning for the use of the property at Eastland, and that we would invest our hospitality funds in making those visions and the plans possible.
I want to come back to all of that in a second, but some say that another expansion city, Sacramento, mm-hmm. is anticipating that their team will generate $1.25 million in economic impact every year, and the team's presence would create 1,700 jobs. This is in Sacramento. Do we have any local prognostications?
We do understand that the jobs factor will be pretty similar, that the jobs that you look at and that would be created by having a stadium that operates an additional 20 to 22 days out of a year at a time that the stadium was not being used, that automatically means all of those people that work in the hospitality industry will be working. But then there are also the spinoff jobs of, you know, you don't just bring in a soccer team, you bring in people that are therapists for physical fitness. I mean, a lot of stuff goes on behind the idea of one job multiplies out.
David Tepper, when he bought the Panthers, committed to a big deal. I mean, he spent a lot of money on the Panthers. He's spending more money than anybody has ever spent on a Major League Soccer franchise. He didn't come here to lose. He's getting out of the, I think, investment business and devoting his entire world now.
I doubt that. I doubt if he's getting out of being in. That's his successful work.
He's devoting himself to this, and he really does see Charlotte as, he's not just hot on football and football, he's also high on Charlotte.
Yeah, I don't know if I can, I'm trying to remember, if I had a pen, I would have wrote it down. It was something like, well, since I came to Charlotte, I find a new place to live. It's the greatest, it's gonna be the greatest city for MLS to be in.
You were there, but I didn't notice you joining in.
I was looking at Nicole, his spouse, in the front row, and she was wincing like, stop, Dave, stop.
So he is a visionary, and he has said for months now that Charlotte needs to come to grips with the fact that we are going to be, and we already are, the entertainment and sports capital of the Carolinas. Do you share that vision?
I do. I think that when you look at the economy of sports and entertainment, it's an important part of what we do to attract all those technology and financing businesses here. People have to have the ability to live quality of life, not just at work, but in their free time. And that's why I think it's so important. If we're going to continue to attract people that want to invest in their businesses here, especially in the technology and the financial industry, if we could get some advanced manufacturing in the region around us, if we could actually get this to be the center, that just circle grows out. It goes to Lincolnton. It goes to Gaston. All of those counties become
more. It goes to Rock Hill, too.
It does. does go to Rock Hill. You can't. Lines on a map don't matter.
Yeah.
It's access, the ability to move around and get to and from that matters.
One of the things that surprised me, and probably a lot of other people, was the fact that suddenly Eastland Mall is part of this, the old Eastland Mall area, and the, what's it called, the Gateway area of Charlotte is suddenly part of these plans. And we've been grappling, the city has been grappling, with what to do with the Eastland Mall property for a long, long time. And you said this will put Eastland back on the tax rolls. Does this solve the Eastland Mall problem, or is this a portion of solving it?
It's a portion of solving it. We've done some really good things at Eastland. We've got a new school, a new CMS school out there. There's going to be another charter school out there that the neighborhoods we're going to, I think Tepper has indicated that he wants to work with the businesses around. A lot of people, I think, see this as an opportunity to boost what they're currently doing.
Explain how it will work, because it seems to me they're going to put their team headquarters there, which is essentially an office building. And then they're going to put the practice facility there, which is, I guess, a big field, so the players can and the coaches can work together before they go to the stadium and play their games. How does that help the area? What does that do for people who live around, work around Eastland Mall?
Well, one of the things that it's not just one big field. The soccer world, an MLS world, they require you to develop people. So there's not just the one field for the professionals, but you have other club teams, and there's a youth soccer component. We saw this in Dallas, where there were fields in all over in many of the cities surrounding the region, and Dallas's region had soccer fields built, because you have to continue to invest in the talent base for soccer. And I expect that's what we will see.
The talent base for soccer overall. You're not telling me that we're going to have our own farm team here that we're going to pluck talent from and put on the Major League Soccer.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's if we can get attendance into that stadium of what we Tepper has suggested, there's going to be interest in seeing this grow and seeing the opportunity for other young people to involve.
Charlotte also likes to put the words world class next to its name a lot, and something we have not talked about that I'd like to talk about when we come back from the break is what this does for our exposure on the world stage, because soccer is the world's most popular sport. We'll talk about that with Mayor Vi Lyles, and among other things, including the revival of the Excelsior Club and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded WFAE.
I'm Lisa Worf.
And I'm Steve Harrison.
This August, Charlotte will host the Republican National Convention, which brings up a number of questions.
Why did Charlotte bid on the RNC, and how will it impact the city? And yes, that means you.
Launching January 23rd, Inside Politics, WFAE's new podcast hosted by us,
where we cover the RNC and the 2020 election through the lens of Charlotte.
Subscribe to the Inside Politics podcast now on wfae.org/insidepolitics.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio with the mayor of Charlotte, Mayor Vi Lyles, who joins us on a regular basis, or has been doing so for about a year and a half, 2 years now. This is her first visit of 2020. So we're talking about soccer and how Charlotte likes to be world-class, wants to be world-class, likes to have those words positioned next to its name. And this does put us on the world stage, because soccer is the world's most popular sport. Does it? I mean, will there be other teams coming here from out of the country, or is this simply another local national team that will be followed in the United States but nowhere else?
Well, I'm not the coach or the general manager of our soon-to-be playing soccer team, but we'll be able to play next year. And the teams that will come in, the other 29 teams that, I think it's about 27 that are playing right now, they do bring in international stars. And many people in our city have already decided that they're going to look for that one person that represents their background and their interests.
And will we be hiring? You're not on the team, but will we be hiring people from Europe? Because that's where all the players are.
You'll have to ask Tom Glick that.
Okay,
I mean,
right.
He ran
we'll get Tom
soccer. That's right. You need to get Tom on the
okay.
program. He will be able. I've watched high school soccer enough to be, and that is my limit of expertise.
Okay. Now, I have to ask you an uncomfortable question. Mm-hmm. Katie Peralta, who is with the Charlotte Agenda, was on this program a couple weeks ago during the news roundup and mentioned that she had asked you how you would respond to the criticism that there wasn't a public debate or a public discussion before the $110 million that the city's kicking into this project allegedly was agreed upon. And the letter promising that amount was released on November the 21st. And I believe to this date there has been no public conversation about that. But when she asked you about the criticism, if you listen to the tape, it appears that you initially want to, I'm not going to play all of this, just a piece of this. You initially want to blame the media.
Oh, my.
I would blame you guys. Is that what I, can I say that? Let me tell you, this is how it is.
When okay, we'll take that out. So you're blaming the media. Please don't do that.
Oh, I wasn't.
I'll have to come after you.
I know that. It was a very long day. It has been a very, I think people don't realize governance isn't just coming in on Monday nights and raising your hands. And I think I had been traveling the week before on some economic development things, and I was reading the papers from afar, and it would be like this and that, and I was just like, oh, okay. So I remember she said on your show something that I was annoying. So I'm not usually annoying. And sometimes I am annoying.
All right, so it is true. Well, the rest of that comment that you talked to Katie about, you said essentially that when you're spending millions of dollars, you have to be private because you're in a negotiating, you're trying to determine negotiation strategy. You can't do that in public. Otherwise, the other people on the other side know what your hand is, what you got in your hand. So this is $110 million. I think the law says you have to have public discussion before you say we're going to do this. Have we had that discussion? When will we have that discussion? If the $110 million is not absolutely set in stone promised, how much trouble are we all in?
Well, I don't think we're in trouble in any way. I think what we're trying to do is build a collaboration with the many people in this city that want to develop in the right way, mm-hmm. and that participate with us in development. We are not handing over a check for $110 million. And what we are doing is saying we're going to invest in planning and development, and we're going to include the community in that. You know, every area plan that we've done, Center City plan that we've done, hasn't been inclusive of neighborhoods, and that's what the expectation is. It's not just about soccer. It's what do you want the Eastland Corridor to look like? What do you want the Gateway Corridor to look like? And that's going to take some time and energy to do.
So you're telling me that David Tepper's not getting the check? This is going to other things?
You said that we have to have public input. You said that, and
right.
I agree with that. And we have to have public input before we spend the money.
Okay, so the $110 million will come, if it comes at all, from city hospitality funds, which is the motel, hotel, restaurant tax. So it's not really coming from property taxes. It's not coming from extra sales tax on people. It's coming from things that a revenue stream that we already have. But I'm told, although even city council is having trouble getting this information, that revenue stream is stretched pretty thin. It funds a lot of things. So how many current and future projects are depending on that money from the hospitality tax, and how close are we to trying to squeeze lemonade out of a turnip?
You know, Mike, I worked in the city. I was the city's budget director for more years than I'd like to count. I don't think that the city has ever done anything that wasn't soundly examined with a financial analysis and a debt management program that we've had working for us for years.
Except we've seen recent things. Maybe this is the county and not the city, but the $77 million shortfall on the Greenway project. I'm not sure that what you just said is absolutely
true.
But
it wasn't a shortfall. It was an unknown. It wasn't like we said $77 million.
What about the unknowns here?
Well, the unknowns, I think that we are much more solid on what we expect out of our hospitality industry. We work very closely with our hospitality I guess, investors or people that run that business. And when you think about this work, it's going to bring in indirect and direct costs of the soccer team coming into the industry is like $150 million over a longer term of period. They understand that you have to invest in something to get the return on it. And I don't think that we've had... And I want to say first, I understand that everybody in the city pays when they go to a restaurant. So I don't take this lightly. It is something that our citizens pay for when they're buying, you know, food and going out to entertainment venues. So we recognize that, but we will not do something that puts our AAA rating in any jeopardy.
I just want to tell you that our Cracker Jack producers have gone and listened to the tape of the program that we did in which Katie Peralta talked about your comment, and she said that you seemed annoyed at her question, not that you were annoying.
There is a difference. Well, there is a difference. Katie, I'm so sorry if I felt like I was being annoying to you. Was the statement. You're right.
Another early Christmas present for Charlotte came when it was announced that a group in California had decided to buy the storied Excelsior Club on Bates Ford Road for $1.35 million. Evidently, they're intent on saving the facade of that building to put up a restaurant and hotel complex, but the interior is in such bad shape that it probably can't be saved. So do you think that that finally ends the worry over what might happen to the Charlotte landmark?
I think that we're certainly supportive of this effort. It's really regrettable that we got to this place where only the facade of the front of the building will be able to be incorporated into this project. We're losing a lot of things. This week, actually, one of the reasons that I was not informed about the Ben Carson event was that my daughter, who lives in Washington, D.C., was trying to drive on Bates Ford Road, and she ended up driving in through several of the neighborhoods over there. And she remarked on the modern architecture that's growing over there, mm-hmm. you know, the stucco two-story mm-hmm. buildings. And she said to me, well, aren't we losing our design or architectural standards of our history there? And I think the Excelsior Club is one of those things that we're going to be proud of because we're able to incorporate it. I'm a little bit more concerned about Washington Heights, Macquarie Heights, Dalebrook, where people have ranch-style houses, and are we going to be able to preserve those neighborhoods? Those are the good parts of Bates Ford Road that very seldom people talk about. I hear so much about LaSalle and Bates Ford Road, and I understand that. But the hard work of the city in the black community has been Bates Ford Road, and it has been where people that outstanding Pop Miller came from, where people, you know, Mr. Blake at West Charlotte, we've got to figure out how to look at that area and see its historic value. I hope that our Historic District Commission will take a look seriously at what those neighborhoods are and just not pull out the Excelsior Club, but make it something that represents our African-American commitment to the city and not just be, you know, one of those that we write stories about.
The city is putting $50,000 toward this preservation project and the redevelopment project of that site. It's in the form of a loan to California-based Kenwood Investments. They have the buyer of the property. How will that money be used, and what are the terms of the loan?
Well, the loan is about the preservation of whatever can be preserved. So it's going to likely be focused on how do we preserve and maintain and store until the development plan is absolutely completed.
And the money will be paid back with interest?
The money will be paid back if the development does not occur and use it appropriately. It is money that we ordinarily have done to preserve and maintain storage until something can happen with the facade. So it is a loan to complete and put the facade in place. It does not have to be paid back if all of those commitments are made.
So even as we are on the verge of keeping a piece of Charlotte history, we lost a little of Charlotte history just before New Year's. Charlotte lost one of its greats, Charles Jones.
Yeah.
He passed away at 82. He was a key figure in the civil rights movement here. I know you were at the funeral.
I actually had the opportunity to speak.
How do you view his contributions?
Well, I think that the neighborhoods that we were talking about, Biddleville, Smallwood, were greatly influenced by his leadership. But you can only imagine someone in their early 20s, in the 60s, willing to march in downtown Charlotte, willing to march on the beltway of Washington, D.C. Charles Jones left us a great legacy, and I have said this clearly. He was one of the people that made it possible for me to sit here today.
Yeah, he was on this program several times over the years, and every time he came in, it was like a ray of sunshine.
Yeah.
I swear to God, when he walked in the room, he was just beaming all the time. And the last time he was on, it was during a public conversation, I think, that we had here at Spirit Square in the McGlohan Theater. And I asked him that night what the main thing he was fighting for in the struggle for civil rights. Was it the right to vote or the end of Jim Crow? What was it? And that led him to tell a story from his childhood of a pregnant black woman being bayoneted to death by a member of the Klan after her husband had a dispute with a white female clerk at a cotton depot.
For almost 300 years, power structure in the South had built fortunes around free labor. They were not about to give up any of that. So the niceties that we bring to this discussion are well and good, and it gives us a comfort zone, but I grew up remembering that image. So I had to try to make democracy safe for the world. So that's what it was about for us.
You notice he got slightly emotional there. Yeah. And toward the end, the last several times he was on here, when he was talking about things that he talked about before, he became very emotional about them. What do you think that was about?
I actually think that the older you get, the more you see the world through your eyes of your own actions and contributions to change, especially when you're African American. And what did you do, and how could you have done so much when so many things were stacked against you? I mean, his father was laying the foundation by creating Sunday schools throughout the South that became churches where Martin Luther King and Thurgood Marshall could stay. You think about that. He was there. He was physically present when there was a Stokely and there was a SNCC and there was fights that were going on across this country. It's not just the Deep South. I mean, it was everywhere. And I think that what you saw was just that understanding and depth of completion to yourself.
Wow. He was an inspiration, I'll tell you.
He truly was.
On another topic, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who is obviously running for president now, has opened a campaign office just a couple of blocks from where we're sitting this morning. And you welcomed Michael Bloomberg to Charlotte at the opening of that office. You introduced him. Are you supporting his candidacy?
You know, I am a Democrat that is in a city that's very democratic, but more importantly, in a city that has to have a president that gets things done for urban communities. He certainly has that strength. And so I look at Michael Bloomberg as a great addition to the field. I hope that at some point the Democrats will make a decision, and I will back that Democratic candidate because I believe that the Democrats have to work on solving problems of the working families in our city right now. We need help. We need the ability to build transportation systems. We need the ability to have great public schools. That's how I'll make a decision on the support of a candidate.
Well, when he was here last year to announce Charlotte as the winner of the American Cities Climate Challenge, you told the crowd, "I am a better mayor because of Michael Bloomberg. We are a better city because of Michael Bloomberg. And I think this country can be a better country because of Mike Bloomberg." From those words and what you just said, why aren't you endorsing him right now?
Michael Bloomberg, I think, has been very careful to say that the work that he committed to do during his foundation is very different than the work that he's doing for the politics. What I mean by that is that if you have a mayor that's on the ground and a city, you need to you understand better urban communities. And Charlotte is one of those. And that's what I think is important.
You're going to be very disappointed because I'm out of time. And I don't get to ask you about Baylor University head coach Mike Rhule.
Welcome, Mike. Coach Rhule, thanks. We're glad to see you here.
I was going to ask you for your... Did David Tepper, since you know him so well now, consult you on this selection?
I doubt seriously. If he didn't ask me about the soccer team recruitment, I'm definitely not on the coaches' list.
Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is with us periodically through the year. Thank you for joining us for the first time in 2020. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.